Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
So welcome, everyone, back to Blood River Radio. This is your host, Jason Grob, and I'm filling in the seat for Eddie Miller, who's not feeling well today. So we've been having a really great discussion, the third hour, fourth hour, and then we got the fifth hour, and we had, we still have Monica Schaefer, who was on the fourth hour, and we have Gerhard Rudolph as well. And what we're doing is Gene Andrew is coming on in the fifth hour, but we're going to rob some of his time. And the first quarter, we're going to have Monica Schaefer continue to stay on. And then we're going to have Gerhard Rudolph also stay on for the first quarter. And they've been talking about the summit and various other things. So I am going to let Monica continue on interviewing Gerhard. And so, Monica, whenever you're ready.
Okay, well, like Eddie always says, we're fly by the seat of our pants on this show. It's live radio, and things are sometimes unexpected. But you did surprise me with the fourth and fifth hour, so maybe you've been doing some other work before these. I thought Eddie was only doing 3 hours, but anyway, be that as it may.
I don't know. It seems like it's been 4 or 5 hours.
He's using great. Roman numerals. That's why we got confused.
Oh, that's what it is. Oh, that's perfect. I like it. Okay. So, Gerhard, just before that, before we went to the when before the last hour ended, shall I say?
The fourth you hour.
Yeah, explaining what you were persecuted on and what you got in trouble for, and you're just starting to talk about evidence. You wanted to continue with that, and I think you also wanted to share a little story with us about what happened in this last hour. Go ahead, over to you.
So my activity as a forensic expert and expert witness led to Germany changing the case law and actually declaring it a crime to introduce evidence contesting the Holocaust narrative as it stands to the mainstream. And of course, it didn't remain there. They were going after me too. I got eventually prosecuted and sentenced for my expert report because it allegedly incites hatred against Jews. So I got 14 months, even though I mentioned Jews with not a single word, Jews on a topic there. But anyway, I got 14 months in prison for this, but I didn't have to serve initially. And then 5 more cases were pending for books I was writing on the topics or articles. And so that's enough. I left, I went into exile, but eventually I came to the United States, applied for political asylum. They deported me in violation of US law back to Germany, where they let me serve the 14 months back in 2005, and they indicted me for books I had written here in the United States where it's perfectly legal, but in Germany all this stuff is illegal. So I was put in for another 30 months, so I spent 44 months all in all for historical research and historical publications. Because Germany is one of the leading nations that had prescribed the writing of history with government guns drawn, in plain language. And that's just the situation that it is. They are 27 among the Western nations now. Canada is unfortunately among them, as you know. And I eventually managed, after long litigation, come back to the United States, and here I am, and I continue. The Holocaust Summit is the last iteration of my efforts to bring the good gospel, the good news of that we're not gas chambers, fortunately. This horror, this nightmare of mankind history is over to the masses. And we will see. We will try again February 7th, so Saturday next week, to have let it happen this time. Now, the reason why I was late, first of all, I turned my phone on mute when I took a nap and forgot to put it on again, so I didn't hear your call coming in. But the other issue is because I was so laser focused on getting a project out, which is the yearly print volume of Inconvenient History. This is our periodical, mainly online, on codoh.com, codoh.com. If you go there on the hat, top menu, you find periodicals. If you click on that, a menu comes up with the various periodicals we have there. One of them is Inconvenient History, and that's the one that's currently live. All the other ones have ceased publication over the past decades. But this one keeps going. We're on the 18th volume now, the 18th year, and it's 550 pages of hard-hitting research and revelations and documentation of skewed history and rectifying the record. And this is what I'm currently working on. Comes out probably in a or two or three, well, it depends on the proofreaders to get that, how fast they are, but 500 pages plus is not a small job to chew through for them. So we'll see. Sometime February, March, maybe it comes out.
And fantastic, Guillermo. Collection.
So
fantastic.
Almost and working. I've always an excuse that I'm working. I'm not taking time off. That's just not much.
No, you're one of the hardest working men I know. But you're, especially when one looks at your output, you produce and produce and produce. Like the latest, well, before this current thing, you produce this Holocaust encyclopedia. Now, sometimes, Guillermo, I see references made in the mainstream to Holocaust encyclopedia, and these were prior to yours. So there must be some kind of a mainstream, but it would be full of their stories, their lies, Holocaust encyclopedia. Is that, am I right about that? Was that something in hard copy or just online? What is that that sometimes gets confused for, you know, because you made a Holocaust encyclopedia, but it's,
right.
You know, a real one.
99% of people still look for mainstream Holocaust encyclopedias. Let them look and find ours and they won't know what hit them. So there's a good reason why we do this. Yes, there are four mainstream Holocaust encyclopedias. The oldest is from 1990. There was no internet around. In the meantime, most of them have actually moved online. The U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum has one. Yad Vashem has one. These are the two biggest. But they are very superficial. They have hardly any sources, if any at all. And you don't find answers to really crucial questions there. You have to go to ours, which is online too. And we have the best website for it. That's holocaustencyclopedia.com.
And perfect.
The others are in English. Ours is available in English, German, Spanish, and French. And I'm currently working with a professional translator in the Arab world to get the Arabic edition out, which hopefully will be done within a month or two. So I'm not just working on this project, but also on that and others and the summit and what have you. We have many more languages to come. So it's the only encyclopedia in the world that's going to be available in all languages of the world that are of importance and some that are not so important because some are just enthusiastic helping us to get them out in more isolated languages. But, you know, it takes a lot of time to get this done. You know, I can't really, I have to hope that our Arabic professional does a good job because if I look at an Arabic book, it looks like a pot of spaghetti to me.
So, Guillermo, in your spare time, like, do you have any, you know, knitting projects?
I have a puppy. I have a puppy, and he's harassing me right now because he had dinner, and now he insists on his walk. He is entirely.
Yes, well, very soon. But I would say just let people know again where they can find more information. And I think that one website has the links to various other websites. Is that not the case? Like even just for this holocaustsummit.com, I do believe I've seen links there to your other websites. Go ahead, over to you.
Yes, CODO.com, CODOH.com. Committee on Open Debate for the Holocaust has them all there. The Academy, where we teach, the summit, where we gather, the encyclopedia, where we lay it all out in short terms, the Holocaust handbooks, where you can get the deep dives, the store, where you can buy the books, and all the rest of it. So that's probably the best hub, also the periodical I just mentioned, the best hub to go from where you can branch out. It's CODOH.com, CODO.com, Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust.
And
my
personal website,
if people are interested in that, is just myname.com, so GammaRudolph.com. Make sure the Rudolph is with an F. So I'm not the red nose Rudolph. I'm the one with the F, not the red nose.
That's great. Yeah, even to answer the question, why do you support open debate on the Holocaust, the answer to that question is criminalized in Germany, even if you never mentioned whether the Holocaust happened or not. Alfred and I know that from firsthand experience, Germar.
Right.
How do you like
Freedom of speech is the central human right that sets us apart from animal, our ability to doubt what our senses make us believe, to investigate and then to communicate with others what we have found. That is the true core of human activity, of the human existence. And whoever curtails that will find my utmost resistance. Free speech needs to be defended where it's threatened most, and it's threatened most when it comes to the Holocaust narrative.
That's a perfect way to end this segment. Thank you, Germar.
Get ready to be part of something incredible. We're breaking barriers and delivering the powerful stories that mainstream media won't touch. Your support is what fuels our mission to revolutionize journalism and bring you the truth. Join our passionate community of changemakers by donating at libertynewsradio.com today. Together, we're creating the future of news.
I'm Michael Hill, president of the League of the South. I and my compatriots are Southern nationalists. We seek the survival, well-being, and independence of the Southern people, our people. The League wants a South that enjoys the sweet fruits of Christian liberty and prosperity, but our current situation won't allow it. We must have our independence from Washington, D.C. and the globalists. The present system cannot be reformed. Without independence, we will continue down this path of destruction. To us, this is not acceptable. I'm asking you, Southern man and woman, to join us today to free the South. Call us at 256-757-6789 or see our website at www.leagueofthesouth.com. God save the South.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an Immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
Tell you something, boy, if I did give you power, you got nothing. Nobody gives you power. Real power is something you take.
Well, welcome back to Blood River Radio. This is your host, Jason Robb, filling in for Eddie Miller. And this final hour, last segment, I said for 4 or 5 hours, so I misspoke. This is the third hour and the 5 o'clock part. And so we have Gene Anders now that's on the air. Monica Schaefer and Gerhard Rudolph, they have exited the show. That was a very good segment. We really appreciate them being on. And so now we have Gene Anders, and we were talking about the break, about a couple things he's going to be talking about, some great birthdays in January that some may not be aware of. So, Gene, tell us about some of these great birthdays.
All right, be glad to do that. Well, of course, we get beat over the head with the federal designated day, but there were before that, we actually celebrated birthdays of two great Confederate heroes in January. Robert E. Lee was born January 19th, 1807, in Westmoreland County, Virginia, and, of course, rose to be the leader of the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia and a brilliant military strategist, and one of the most devout Christian leaders in the history of our country. And, of course, he's been smeared and tarred and everything else, lied about. But there are some of us that believe in actual history. I have several signs that are made out of that white styrofoam board for Confederate birthdays, and they're about 3 feet by 2 feet. and I have the metal, like an H that, you know, you put under the sign, like a for sale sign. I always stick out them in my front yard there for these Confederate birthdays. It's kind of a drive-by history lesson. So the one Lee has his picture on it, and it says, Robert Edward Lee, born January 19, 1807. And then I always have a quote from him. And Lee's quote is, if those people, and I put in quotes Yankees, if those people win this war, the United States will become a bully abroad and a tyrant at home. And then end quote, Robert R. E. Lee. And I try to put things out there that people really don't see very much of, and certainly don't see it in the so-called education system that we have today. Right. It's all just propaganda. So Lee was certainly an amazing individual. He was a son of Harry Lee, who served as Washington's chief of cavalry during our first war for independence. His father was a greater soldier than he was a businessman or a plantation owner. He was actually, Harry Lee was actually in prison for debt. And he died of wounds that he suffered when he was trying to disperse a lynch mob in Baltimore. And Robert Edward was raised by his widowed mother, and they had lost their plantation home because of his father's inability to manage money and all the things he'd gone through. So they had to live with relatives most of his life. And they were living in Alexandria, Virginia, when he got an appointment to West Point. Wasn't really that crazy about the military, but a West Point education was a free education, and that's the only thing they could afford, of course. So he entered the United States Military Academy at West Point in 1825. Brilliant, brilliant student. Graduated second in his class. He was commissioned as second lieutenant and assigned to the engineers, which was sort of the premier assignment back in those days, to be an engineer officer. And one of his projects, he actually saved the port of St. Louis. There was a huge sandbar building up on the west bank, or the St. Louis bank of the Mississippi River, and it was closing down the port of St. Louis. And so he came up with an idea to drive these pilings into the river on the east side of the river, over on the Illinois side, and force the current back toward the west to the Missouri side. And after 3 or 4 years, it cut this sandbar away, and he's credited with saving the port of St. Louis. And during the Mexican War, he served under General Winfield Scott in Mexico, and Scott claimed that Lee was his most outstanding officer. He married during this time, he married Mary Custis, who was the great granddaughter of Martha Washington. And the Arlington Custis home is there, overlooking Washington, D.C., up on that bluff, if you look out from Washington across the Potomac there. And Lee was not a slave owner himself. He inherited the slaves of his father-in-law, who was a very wealthy businessman, and built that home. And so they say, well, Lee was fighting for slavery, and, oh, he was a terrible person. Well, those are people that don't know anything about history. Lee said, he actually freed his slaves that he inherited from his father-in-law before the 13th Amendment, before Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which didn't free any slaves at all, and before the first shot was fired during the War for Independence, which they claim was the war to end slavery. So he was against slavery before any of the government officials in the North or the South were. And he said that slavery is an evil that taints both the white man and the black man. Reason being, whites get to a point that said, well, I'm not doing a job like that. That's for blacks to do that. And he said, if it's honest labor, it's not beneath anybody's dignity to work. And the blacks got used to living off the whites. They expected whites to furnish their housing, their clothing, their food, their medical expenses, which has pretty much come down to us today. The same thing.
Nothing's changed.
No, that hadn't changed at all. So anyway, he had fought during the Mexican War, served with the cavalry in Texas after the war. He returned to Arlington to take care of his sick wife, who had quite a few health issues. And while he was back in Washington, or right outside of Washington, across the river to Arlington, he was asked by General Scott to take a detachment of Marines to Harper's Ferry. They were the only troops that were in the Washington area. and do something about this insurrection that was started by John Brown, who had been out in the Kansas Territory murdering whites. And Brown was a real nutcase zealot, and he was so anti-slavery that he murdered a family on the Pottawatomie Creek in the Kansas Territory because he didn't want Kansas to come in as a slave state. And mainly, if it had been a slave state, they would have elected two Democratic senators, and they didn't want to tip the balance of power for the Whig Party in Washington. Back then, the nutcase party was the Whigs and later the Republican Party, and the Democrats were the Conservative Party, which today is just turned around the opposite way.
Right.
But if you had all AOC and Comrade Bernie Sanders and Madami from New York and Chuck Hugh Schumer and what's her name? The crazy black woman from Texas, whatever her name is.
Crockett.
Yeah, not Ken to Davy Crockett.
No, definitely not.
Anyway, they would have been in the Republican Party back then. So anyway, General Scott, Lee was the highest ranking officer in Washington next to Scott. So I asked him to take a detachment of Marines on the train that night up to Harper's Ferry and find out what in the heck was going on up there. This crazy guy had come in with a bunch of armed people. They tried to take over the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, and the citizens of Harper's Ferry opened fire on them and drove them away from the arsenal and back to the engine house in the railroad yard. So I think that's a good point for the Second Amendment, and we want to underline that again. The armed citizens of Harper's Ferry stopped John Brown and his terrorists from taking over the arsenal and delivering, and the whole point of it was to arm the slaves and have a giant slave uprising against the whites in the South. And this was no idle threat to Southern whites because they had seen what had happened in Haiti when the blacks attacked the French, the white French settlers in Haiti and murdered not only the men, but the women and the children and chased them out of Port-au-Prince and away from the settlements and up into the mountains. And they went after them with machetes and axes and just hacked them and chopped them to death. So to have something like that thrown on the South was just more than people were going to put up with. And that was one reason why they wanted to withdraw from the Union and get away from people, crazy people like that. So on that train that night, this is an interesting situation. You had Robert E. Lee, who was a colonel in the U.S. Army, who in 1859, in 3 years, he would be commander of the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia. He asked for a young second lieutenant to go with him who had just served in Kansas with the U.S. Cavalry because he thought this young lieutenant could recognize Brown and some of his followers to make sure they didn't harm any civilian hostages. So the young lieutenant was second lieutenant James Ewell Brown Stewart, Jeb Stewart, who in 2 years would be Lee's chief of cavalry in the Army of Northern Virginia. The commander of the Marine detachment was Lieutenant Israel Green. And in 2 years, he would be the assistant commandant of the Confederate States Marine Corps and be promoted to Major Israel Green in the Confederate States Marine Corps. So you had these three future prominent Confederate officers heading to Harper's Ferry to take care of John Brown and his crazy wackos there.
That's interesting.
Yeah, interesting kind of a coincidence there. When it looked like the country was going to be falling apart and Lincoln said that he needed to goad the South into the seven seceded states into a war so he had an excuse to invade them and force them back into the Union. So the United States is a great country. If you don't agree with them, they'll put the bayonet to you or the rifle barrel to you and force you to be a part of their country. So anyway... after Lincoln did everything he could to lie to the peace delegate that was sent to Washington and sent a fleet to Charleston Harbor to get the war started that he wanted, and we'll tell you what happened after that when we get back from our break.
How would you like to help this program reach more people and earn silver at the same time? Call or text 801-669-2211 for complete details.
News this hour from Town Hall. I'm Mary Rose. Multiple people are injured after a shooting during the Mardi Gras in the country parade in Clinton, Louisiana. Local media report, at least three people were shot with as many as six injured. President Trump said he made the right choice by deciding to nominate Kevin Warsh to the lead Federal Reserve.
He's very smart, very good, strong, young, pretty young, and I think he's going to do good. I mean, he was the central casting guy that people wanted.
Warsh will have to be confirmed by the Senate. It's safe to say he won't be getting a yay from the Senate Banking Committee's top Democrat, Elizabeth Warren.
Kevin Warsh has already stood up in public as part of his tryout for attracting Donald Trump's attention and just claimed that up is down, in is out, black is white, he doesn't care.
Economist Steve Moore says President Trump's tax cut package passed by Congress last year is going to be a big boost for everyday Americans.
The vast majority of the tax cut went to the middle class, not rich people. I mean, and so I'm writing column now. What tax cut for the rich are they talking about? The average family is going to save about $2,000 or $3,000 this year on their taxes thanks to the big beautiful bill.
Power outages stretching into a second week are fueling frustration across the South, especially in Nashville. National Weather Service forecaster Bob Orovec says Florida is expected to see a rare frost.
Cold temperatures are definitely getting down to Florida, especially as we move on into the weekend. Saturday will be a okay day, but as we go into Sunday morning and then especially Monday morning, the low temperatures across much of the peninsula are going to be in the low to mid-20s as you get away from the coast.
More on these stories at townhall.com.
Whether you're preparing for exams, juggling family and career, or just looking to stay sharp as you age, Think Factor is here to help. Created by the same company that makes Relief Factor, Think Factor supports sharper focus, stronger recall, and clearer thinking. It's the natural way to give your brain the daily nutrients it needs for memory, attention, and even vibrant vision. Call 800-4-RELIEF. 800, the number 4-RELIEF, or visit relieffactor.com to learn more. Look, I was a little bit skeptical. I started taking Think Factor. After a few weeks, wow, my memory, my focus, my concentration, better than ever. And Think Factor results get better the longer it's taken. If you want to stay focused during demanding tasks, keep your memory strong, maintain mental energy for whatever's ahead, well, Think Factor is for you. Call 800-4-RELIEF, 800, the number 4-RELIEF, or visit relieffactor.com to learn more and order Think Factor. Your first bottle is just $19.95. Think Factor. Think clearer, perform better daily. Call 800-4-RELIEF. Or visit relieffactor.com for Think Factor.
Hey, this is Matt from Blood River Radio. Blood River Radio is your voice to save our land, our people, and our future. We propose Christian solutions to an anti-Christian assault on our bloodlines. We love what we do, but we cannot do it without your help. The annual operating cost of Blood River Radio is more than even a team of people should bear alone. With your donation, we can take the fight to our enemies and hold our own people accountable for their treachery against us. Please go to our website, www.bloodriverradio.com, and find a way to help us that is suitable for you. We are thankful for any cash, check, or money orders we get. We also appreciate your correspondence or letters of encouragement. Once again, please help, and thank you for joining the fight.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
Step into the boots of the American West with Range Magazine, where grit meets grace. This is a front row seat to the stories, struggles, and triumphs of ranchers, farmers, and stewards of the land. From jaw-dropping photography to no-nonsense reporting, Range brings you the untold tales of life on the range. Whether you're a city dweller with a cowboy's heart or living life where the pavement ends, Range speaks to the soul of the West. Subscribe today at rangemagazine.com.
Smell of napalm in the morning. Smells like victory.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Ooh, they're red, white, and blue.
Welcome back to Blood River Radio. This is your host, Jason Robb, filling in for Eddie Miller. And we have Gene Anders on. And before the break, he was talking about a historical fact that I was not even aware of regarding Lee and Green and Stewart. So I am going to go give it back to Gene. And Gene, if you can continue on that historical lesson that I was not even aware of.
Well, we were talking a little bit about Lee's career before being commander of the Confederate Army in Northern Virginia, which was where he gained his fame. He was quite a hero during the war with Mexico and received several promotions and the praise of General Winfield Scott, who was the leader of the American expedition into Mexico, and then came back to Arlington. And while he was in Arlington, taking care of his wife, who had several illnesses, John Brown and his terrorists came to Harper's Ferry, Virginia, to seize the military arsenal there and arm the slaves in an armed uprising, kind of like what happened in Haiti against the whites on the island of Haiti, and have that take place against white slave owners in the South. And, of course, the military was sent. And we were talking, the irony of history was that night that they sent a Marine detachment out of the Marine barracks at 8th and I Street in Washington, which is still there today. It was a Lieutenant Israel Green that was commander of the Marines. And then Winfield Scott asked his most trusted officer, Colonel Robert E. Lee, United States Army, to lead this group. And Lee asked for a young lieutenant from the Western Plains territories, Lieutenant J.B. Stewart, who had served and probably knew what John Brown looked like and some of his followers, because they didn't want to hurt any of the civilian hostages. So he had Robert E. Lee in 2 years going to be commander of the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia, Jeb Stewart, who's going to be his chief of cavalry, and Israel Green, who's going to be promoted to assistant commandant of the Confederate States Marine Corps, all going up there. So they got that taken care of. And then as these seven states left the Union, which was their legal right to do, the 10th Amendment, if you read that, the Constitution says all the powers not granted to the federal government are reserved to the states or to the individuals. And since the Constitution, today we look at it as something that can impose the federal government on every aspect of our life. But back then, the Constitution was a list of things that the federal government could not do. And since it did not mention secession, then secession was believed by most of the people and even taught at West Point that secession was legal because it wasn't mentioned in the Constitution. If it wasn't mentioned as a prohibition by the states or by the central government, then it was legal. So they didn't see anything wrong with them saying we join voluntarily. Why can't we leave voluntarily? And Lincoln wasn't going to allow that because the South was supporting the federal government. The government in 1860, the federal budget was, and I've read two or three different versions. I've read $102 million up to $104 million, which we laugh at now. I mean, they blow that off just at lunchtime in Washington today. That's nothing,
exactly.
You know, paying for cold beer and hookers or whatever they do in Washington with $102 million. But anyway, out of that, say, 102, the southern states, because of tariffs that were put on cotton and tobacco and cash crops, they were paying $82 million into the federal government. And so when they left, Lincoln said, well, what will happen to my tariffs? And he knew he had to do something to unite the northern states against the southern states. And it wasn't that all the northerners were against secession. The editor, Horace Greeley, of the New York World. That was the major paper in New York then, before the New York Times. But Greeley said, "Erring sisters, go in peace." And he thought the South was wrong, but he didn't think it was worth fighting a war to force them back in. So Lincoln had to come up with some kind of scam to make the Northerners think that the South was some kind of evil, horrible place. So he sent a military fleet into the harbor at Charleston, South Carolina, to take over a fort under construction. There wasn't any military there at all, just construction workers and a lighthouse keeper. They took over the unfinished fort at Fort Sumter, which effectively blocked the entrance to Charleston Harbor. And they were going to, and Lincoln said, now these states can stay out of the Union and they can keep their slaves, which it wasn't important to us, but it seemed to be important to everybody in the North, thinking, you know, we wanted slavery to continue forever. He said they can stay out of the Union and they can keep their slaves if they pay their taxes to the United States. And we're going, wait a minute. You mean we've got to pay taxes to a foreign government? And I always throw this back at people that say the South was wrong. I say, all right, what if the Russians or the Chinese communists or the Iranians put a missile battery at Verrazano Narrows at New York Harbor? And yeah, ships could come into New York and they could trade with the United States and they could dock in New York. But they had to stop and pay a tax to Red China or Russia or Iran before they could dock in New York Harbor. How long do you think the United States would allow that to happen? And that's exactly what happened. That's the peace delegates that were sent to Washington to try to work out some kind of agreement about this military fort that was held in Charleston and one in Pensacola. Lincoln wouldn't meet with them. He said the South wasn't a real country, so he wouldn't meet with them. He turned them over to Secretary of State Seward, William Seward, and he lied and delayed, and, well, the president will meet with you next week. Well, next week came. Well, something came up. He can't do it today. We'll have to do it next week. And they were stalling while this fleet was being put together in New York to sail down and come into Charleston. The Southerners, they found out about it, and that's when they sent the ultimatum out to Fort Sumter and Major Anderson there and said, look, we know there's a fleet coming, and they're going to come into our territory, our harbor. And they said, if we fire on this fleet, will you return fire from Fort Sumter? And he said, well, I'll have to. If the U.S. flag's fired on, we'll have to return the fire. And so that's why they opened fire on Fort Sumter on April the 12th, 1861, rather. And, of course, that's what Lincoln wanted, because then they waved the flag. Oh, the flag has been fired on, and oh, my goodness gracious, this is a horrible. They're going to be marching into Boston and New York and burning them down any minute right now. So that got the northern population fired up for the war. Now, they needed somebody to command this army. Lincoln called for 75,000 volunteers, and back then we didn't have a large standing army. Each state would, when a war came along, Mexico or War of 1812 or some of the Western Plains Indian Wars, each state had to furnish volunteers from their state militia. And so he called on these states that were still in the Union to furnish their state militias to go south and force the Southerners back into the Union. And the people say, well, firing on Fort Sumter caused six more states to leave the Union. No, it didn't. It was Lincoln's call for volunteers from those states to start a war against the seven states that had left the Union and formed a government in Montgomery, Alabama. It was Lincoln's mm-hmm. call that caused Arkansas, Tennessee, North Carolina, Virginia, Kentucky, and later Missouri to pass an ordinance of secession to Lee. And at the same time, they wanted the best officer in the U.S. Army to command this force. And the Secretary of War, with the blessing of Abraham Lincoln, offered this command to Robert E. Lee, and not just command an army, but command all of the United States troops from Maine to California, and use them to invade the South and force these states back in. Lee said, I can't do it. I can't fight against my own people, because Virginia had voted, by now Virginia had voted to leave the Union. And he said, my family lives right across the river there in Arlington. I mean, you can see my house from the Secretary of War's office in Washington. Yeah. He said, I can't turn exactly against my family. And so he turned it down. Now, he didn't know what was going to happen after that. he assumed that he would return to Virginia and just serve as, you know, just a soldier in the Army of Virginia. Didn't know he was going to be given command of it. But boy, that set them off in Washington that he had turned that down and was going to lead this rebellion, as they called it, against the United States. And that's why they hated him and his family so much, that when they left Arlington to go to Richmond and serve in the Army of Virginia at that time, before it was incorporated into the Confederate Army, they came across the river and took over Arlington and took all of the things from George Washington that were there, Mary Custis had and her family had from the Washington family. And they wanted to disgrace that property. And that's why they made Arlington Cemetery. And they wanted graves placed as close to that house as possible so no one would ever want to live in that house again. And that's why we have Arlington Cemetery where it is today. That all of that area where Arlington Cemetery is was once a property of the Lee family. So we'll go back to our break, and we'll come back one more time to cover a couple of things here.
Are you ready to stand up for your community and support your local sheriff? Join the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association and become a vital member of the Sheriff's Citizens Posse. At CSPOA.org, we empower citizens like you through weekly webinars, arming you with the knowledge to back your constitutional county sheriff. Together, we can uphold our Constitution and ensure liberty and justice for all. Your community needs you now more than ever.
Okay, listen up, people. I'm beating the bushes for a few good men. I don't want you boys the alt-right. I want the hardcore of the hard-right. And I need you front and center, boots on the ground, at a minute's notice, in the streets, and I need your money. You know the problem that the whites of the world face. It's the all-too-real threat of global extermination. And you know what's going on in South Africa and Western Europe. And unless you're semi-comatose, you've already seen the first stages of white genocide unfolding in our country. Our culture is under constant full-scale attack by our enemy. The enemy never sleeps. They spend day and night wrecking the monuments and the graves of our beloved kin. They attack us physically everywhere we go. They've already taken the linen and our stone. Now they're coming after our flesh. And if you're not too squeamish, if you want to be part of the number one white advocacy group and the number one white civil defense group in the United States, then contact Eddie Bombardier Miller at BloodRiverRadio.com. And please, please donate. And God knows you need us as much as we need you. Thank you.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpochTimes.com.
Go ahead, make my day.
All right, welcome back to Blood River Radio. This is your host, Jason Rahm, and we have had Dean Andrews on. And this is the final segment, I believe, until this hour is done. And so I'm going to go back to Gene. And Gene, continue on what you were talking about, this lesson. I told you on the break that you're giving more of a historical lesson than kids are hearing, you know, for 12 years in school. But then you reminded me, they're not been hearing this for 12 years of school.
Yeah. Well, anyway, they really don't teach history today. They teach propaganda. So we were talking about Lee, his career before the war, which very few people know much about, and he turned down the offer to command all of the U.S. Army forces that were going to be sent to force these 7 southern states back into the Union. And then when Lincoln called for an army to invade these states, that's when 6 more states said, we're not doing it. In fact, Governor Isom G. Harris of Tennessee wrote a letter to Lincoln and said, Tennessee will not furnish one single man for coercion, but 50,000 if necessary to defend our rights and those of our fellow southern states. And he had $75,000 in there, and he scratched it out. He thought that was a little over the top, put $50,000. He should have left it because Tennessee furnished 132,000 men to the Confederate Army for the war. And like most other states, like Arkansas and like North Carolina and Virginia, a fourth of them were killed during the war. So it was a huge loss to the male population in the South of what they lost during the war. We're not going to go so much into Lee's military record. You've heard of his victories at 7 days, Second Manassas, Fredericksburg, Chancellorsville, and so forth. At the end of the war, when they were outnumbered and trapped, the army had to abandon the lines at Petersburg. The siege lines at Petersburg, south of Richmond, broke. They had to evacuate Petersburg and Richmond, the capital, and head west, trying to get to the mountains in the western part of the state of Virginia, but were trapped at Appomattox Courthouse, and Lee had to surrender the Army of Northern Virginia. He was later asked to be president of Washington College in Lexington, Virginia. It was a small, kind of a nothing school right there. There were two colleges there. There was Washington College and Virginia Military Institute in Lexington. And so Lee was asked to be president of Washington College and did a lot to bring that college into modern times and gave more up-to-date classes at that school. He was denied his citizenship. He was not allowed to be a citizen. And one thing that a lot of people have brought up, these so-called historians, mostly talking heads on CNN and The View and places like that, that they claim they're historians, they say Lee was a traitor because he had sworn an oath when he got a commission as a United States Army officer to defend the Constitution and defend the country against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I say, well, you don't know much about the military. I said, if he had stayed in the U.S. Army and then spent his time blowing up bridges and cutting telegraph lines and doing things like that, yes, he would have been a traitor. But he resigned from the U.S. Army. And an officer has a very basic minimum amount of time that he has to serve. I was an officer in the Marine Corps, and it was 3 years. And then after that, you're in for as long as you want to be in. And unlike an enlisted man that has to sign up for another three-year tour, sign up for five or something like that, an officer, once you serve your basic enlistment, then you're in for life if you want to be, until you decide that you want to retire after 20 years or you want to retire somewhere else before 20 years. So all you do is you submit your letter of resignation and you're out. And that's what Lee did. He didn't want to be in the U.S. Army and be considered a traitor and fight against the United States military as a citizen of Virginia. So he resigned from the United States Army. So these people that say, well, you know, he was a traitor and all this stuff, they really don't know much about the military, which is pretty much typical of anything on the news media today. The other birthday that we have in January that we celebrate, and I have my sign out in the yard, is on January 21st for the birthday of Thomas Jonathan Jackson, who was later known as Stonewall Jackson. He's born in Clarksburg, Virginia, which is now West Virginia. His parents died, and he was raised in poverty by his uncle. And he barely qualified for an appointment to West Point. But he studied very hard and graduated 17th in a class out of 59. He also served in Mexico. And then he was assigned to forts in New York and Florida. And in 1851, he got was assigned as a professor of artillery and natural philosophy at the Virginia Military Institute in Lexington. He was a stern teacher. He had to memorize a lesson, and if you ask him a question, he couldn't answer it. He'd turn around the next day and start the lesson all over again, word for word, from what he had done the day before.
Oh, wow.
And the students called him Tom Fool. That's a nickname. Of course, they didn't say that to his face. But he commanded the VMI cadets that went to the hanging of John Brown. And then he resigned from the U.S. Army when Virginia seceded, and he was given command of the Army of the Shenandoah and promoted to Brigadier General. He brought his army, it had a brilliant campaign in the Shenandoah Valley, drove three federal armies out of the Shenandoah Valley, and then crossed the mountains and actually threatened Washington before he turned south and joined up with Lee to drive George McClellan away from the gates of Richmond, literally. And there's one story about him that they were marching over the mountains and coming out of the Shenandoah Valley and heading into central Virginia. And there's an old farmer standing on the road, and he was asking him, said, "Well, old General Jackson, where are y'all going?" And Jackson rode over to him, leaned down out of the saddle and asked him, said, "Now, can you keep a secret?" And the old guy said, "Oh, yeah, yeah." And sure enough, if Jackson told him, he was going to tell all his buddies, "Well, old Jack told me they're going here, going there." So he asked this old guy, said, "Now, can you keep a secret?" He said, "Oh, yes, sir, General, I sure can." And Jackson said, "Good, so can I," and tipped his hat and rode off. Anyway, so he commanded an entire corps in Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, and he was sort of the striking force that Lee used to outflank the Federals. In fact, Jackson marched all the way around the Federal Army at Manassas and destroyed their supply depot at Manassas. And then, of course, his most famous battle was at Chancellorsville, where he marched around the flank of Hooker's army and caught the entire 11th Corps just cooking dinner. They thought, they didn't know the Confederates were anywhere around, and they overran that Federal position, just routed them off the field. But it was late in the day, and by the time the sun started going down, the Confederate units and the Union units were all mixed together in this wooded area called the Wilderness. And it's so confusing. And Jackson knew that if they didn't finish off the Federal Army that night, that they weren't going to have a chance to destroy the U.S. Army. He rode out ahead of his lines and was looking for a route through the woods to try to launch this night attack, and couldn't find it. Heard the Federals chopping down trees and building earth breastworks. He committed one of the cardinal sins in the military, that once you go outside of your lines, you always, always come back to the same point because they know you're out there. But in the darkness and all these roads, it was confusing, and he came back to another point in the Confederate lines, and he came in probably the worst place he could come to was a North Carolina regiment that just about 20 minutes before had been hit by Federal cavalry. And so they heard these horses coming up the road, the hooves and the, you know, the bridles and things. They assumed it was Federal cavalry coming back, and this time they didn't order them to halt. They just knew it was Federal cavalry, so they gave the command, "Ready, fire," and they cut loose on them. Two of his staff officers were killed. Jackson was wounded. His horse panicked and bolted, ran off the road, went under a low limb in a tree, knocked him out of the saddle. And now the Yankees heard all this firing coming from where they thought the Confederate lines were. They opened fire. Some of his staff officers that weren't wounded laid on top of him to try to protect him. They finally got him out of there, and his surgeon, Dr. McGuire, later that night amputated his left arm, which was just shattered, and they took a bullet out of his right hand, and he survived the surgery. But what happened was, in the days after the operation, back then they thought they had to keep you completely still and rested, but laying down, he got pneumonia, and pneumonia was what killed him. It wasn't the wounds that he got. He could have recovered from those, but anyway, he died of pneumonia and was buried there in Lexington, Virginia, where he taught at VMI. And to show the honor that the politically correct have for Jackson today, he had a statue on the campus at Virginia Military Institute, but they took that down. And so you know, want to turn their back on any of their history. Now, one thing that Eddie had mentioned we might be talking about was how January was murder month. And he wanted to bring up two horrible murders that took place in the South. One was a young man by the name of Michael Westerman that was murdered and was living in Guthrie, Kentucky, and was murdered on January 14th, 1985. He had left home with his wife. They had two twin daughters that had been born. They finally had a chance to get out and go down to Clarksville, Tennessee, and have dinner together. He had stopped in a convenience store, gotten gas, was leaving, and a carload of blacks from Chicago had followed him, and they didn't like him flying a Confederate flag in the back of their car. They got out of town. They pulled up beside him, opened fire, shot through the door, and hit him. They tried to kill his wife, Hannah, but she got hold of the steering wheel, got the car off the road, turned it around, and got back. But he did not make it through that. He died that later that night when they got him down to the trauma unit at Vanderbilt in Nashville. That was one of the murders. We probably next week talk about the other one, the Knoxville massacre of two students up there that were murdered by a group of blacks, tortured and then murdered. So We've started calling January the murder month. Anyway, hope we learned some facts tonight, and we'll pick that up again next week.
Well, thank you, everyone, and thank you for Blood River Radio, and we will talk to you and listen to everyone next week.